Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO in Portland. This is Norm Diamond, your host. Patricia Kohlberg will join us as our producer, engineer, reader in some of what we do this morning, and Jill of all trades. This is our last Old Mole during Women's History Month, and today's program is designed with that theme in mind. We've got pirates on today's show. It probably won't surprise you to learn that their ranks, even their leadership, included women. And we have revolutionaries, definitely including women. And we even have some gender confusion. You'll see what I mean. Along with some great music and live radio drama, in which I'm joined by some great female performers. Later in the program, I'll honor an Old Mole tradition and reprise a performance piece by Ursula K. Le Guin on the non-recognition of women in history. I, a man, will portray Ursula, a woman, who claims that she, in turn, must be a man. Confusing? It'll all work out. Before that, and with considerable help by skilled performers, I'll draw on a remarkable new book, Zapatista Stories for Dreaming an Other World, to update us on the EZLN of southern Mexico, and look at some of their ongoing organizing through the parables they tell. And leading off the program, Fran Michel tells us that stories about pirates are also tales about resistance to capitalism through multiracial democracy and sexual and gender liberty. Stories, then, tall tales and parables, are another theme for today's Old Mole. Music this morning will be from Hazel Scott and Nina Simone. Bookending Fran's provocative piece on pirates is Nina Simone's great version of Pirate Jenny from Kurt Weill and Bertolt Brecht's The Three Penny Opera.
And they pile up the bodies, and I say, that'll learn ya.
Weill's Three Penny Opera, the song Pirate Jenny expresses a downtrodden woman worker's desire for revenge against her oppressors and for autonomy and adventure for herself. She imagines a pirate ship giving her the decision to destroy her enemies and giving her the chance to depart with the pirates. It's a fantasy, but it has some grounding in truth. There were, historically, women pirates in what's known as the Golden Age of Piracy, the late 17th and especially the early 18th century. Among the most famous were Anne Bonny and Mary Read, whom we know of because they had the bad luck to enter the historical record by getting caught. The employment opportunities available to women in piracy is of a piece with other things we know about pirates in that early 18th century era. As both scholarly sources and popular culture record, Golden Age pirates formed communities far more egalitarian and democratic than the wider society. Peter Linebaugh and Marcus Redeker note in their book, The Many-Headed Hydra, Sailors, Slaves, Commoners, and the Hidden History of the Revolutionary Atlantic, first published in 2000, that, quote, women were few aboard ships of any kind in the 18th century, but they were numerous enough to inspire ballads about cross-dressing female warriors that became popular among the workers of the Atlantic. Bonny and Reed, whose exploits were announced on the cover page of A General History of the Pirates, and no doubt in many another yarn of their own day and after, cursed and swore like sailors, carried their weapons like those well-trained in the ways of war, and boarded prize vessels as only the most daring and respected members of pirate crews were permitted to do. Operating beyond the reach of the traditional powers of family, state, and capital, and sharing in the rough solidarity of life among maritime outlaws, they added another dimension altogether to the subversive appeal of piracy by seizing the liberties usually reserved for men at a time when the sphere of social action for women was narrowing." End quote. Linebaugh and Redeker's book focuses on the multicultural proletarian resistance to the massive organization and exploitation of human labor that enabled the rise of capitalism, and they highlight the congruence among the plantation, the factory, and the ships, both mercantile and military, that linked the transatlantic economy. Writing history from below, they note, they recover some of the lost history of the multi-ethnic class that was essential to the rise of capitalism and the modern global economy. The historic invisibility of many of the book's subjects owes much to the repression originally visited upon them. The violence of the stake, the chopping block, the gallows, and the shackles of a ship's dark hold. Ships brought together workers from around the world. In Europe, the enclosure of land and the removal of thousands of people from the commons, the common land that had previously been the source of shared resources and survival, meant that people were displaced and redeployed to the country, town, and sea. Expropriation was the source of the original accumulation of capital and the force that transformed land and labor into commodities. Those sailors, often conscripted, press-ganged, or kidnapped into their new roles, suffered brutal top-down control. But they also encountered each other, and thus began to develop a common language and a common culture of resistance and rebellion. As David Graeber notes in his posthumously published book, Pirate Enlightenment, or The Real Libertalia, which came out this year, these rebellious and globally multicultural environments became perfect laboratories of democratic experiment. While Graeber's focus is on pirate communities in Madagascar, he places these in context of the Enlightenment ideas and pirate legends of the era, as part of a project of decolonizing the Enlightenment, suggesting that the popularity of pirate legends marks them as themselves a material force in history. He calls them the most important form of poetic expression produced by the emerging North Atlantic proletariat, whose exploitation laid the ground for the Industrial Revolution. Unlike the lawful ships they escaped from or took over, pirate ships were noted for democracy, electing their captains, collectively agreeing on their codes of conduct, offering every sailor a say in major decisions, and providing a system of checks and balances in operation. As Graeber points out, the phenomenon of pirate amity was real. Although they were constantly armed and frequently drunk, they virtually never came to blows with one another. This amicable democratic governance extended to their economies, since both rations and booty were usually divided fairly equally. Even if the captain and officers got twice or one and a half times the share of loot that a common sailor got, that difference was far less than in legal military or mercantile ships, or certainly in modern corporations. They also offered workers' compensation. The common image of pirates with eye patches, wooden legs, or hooks for hands reflected some of the physical dangers of sailing, but those injured were generally given a larger share of any prizes. The popular tales of pirates that resonate most for me today are not those in boys' books or Disney rides, but two televisual series that offer especially egalitarian, anti-imperialist, and queer tales. Black Sails, which streamed on Stars from 2014 to 2017, and Our Flag Means Death, which will be releasing a second season on HBO sometime this year. As in historical accounts, the casts are multiracial and multigender. Graeber notes that a pirate ship might include Englishmen, Swedes, escaped African slaves, Caribbean Creoles, Native Americans, and Arabs. And both series reflect such diversity in the crews we see. These pirate tales also include women, as I began by noting, and they also include queer people. Evidence suggests that Anne Bonny and Mary Read were lovers, and that sexual relationships between men were common on pirate ships, even sanctioned by the relation of maître-l'otage. Our Flag Means Death also includes a non-binary character played by a non-binary actor. Both series offer forms of class critique from below. Black Sails is more serious, violent, and explicitly anti-imperialist, while Our Flag Means Death is much lighter and funnier and more gay. These shows do include, between them, most of the romantic clichés of the genre that are omitted from Under the Banner of King Death, Pirates of the Atlantic, a graphic novel out this year from Marcus Rediker and David Lester with Paul Boole. That book offers no hunts for buried treasure, no ghost ships, no wronged aristocrats driven to sea, and no pirates in love with the governor's beautiful daughter. But all of these texts still speak to why we need pirates. As long as there are powerful people to be resisted and causes of social justice to be fought for. For The Old Mole, this has been Fran Michel.
You people can watch while I'm scrubbing these floors, and I'm scrubbing the floors while you're gawking.
Thank you, Fran Michel, with a bit of song from Nina Simone. It's time now for Another World is Possible. We call this part of The Old Mole, Another World is Possible. AWP is a concept that goes back to antiquity. When Plato wrote The Republic, for instance, he was attempting to persuade his readers and fellow citizens that a society starkly different from the one they lived in was conceivable. At the level of practice, and even earlier, organized groups encountering other organized groups would have been aware that not all people constructed their societies the same, that a whole range of authority structures, of political and economic coordination, was possible. David Graeber and David Wengrow make that point in their recent book, The Dawn of Everything, and Kim Stanley Robinson has a contemporary novel, Shaman, that's partly about those early encounters and that recognition of alternatives. So much for the concept of AWP. As a slogan, Another World is Possible is associated with the World Social Forum, international meetings that began early this century to oppose the kind of globalization forced on us by neoliberal capitalism. One of the key inspirations for those meetings, and a group often associated with the slogan, is the Zapatista Army for National Liberation, the EZLN, the Zapatistas of Southern Mexico. We haven't heard much recently about the Zapatistas, but they've been active, and the semi-autonomous region they coordinate continues to grow. Notice my careful attempt at phrasing, because it's not easy to characterize the kind of society they're attempting to create and their role in it. I said semi-autonomous, where they say autonomous, because they're still part of and surrounded by conventional Mexico. I said coordinate, but perhaps facilitate would be better. Their model of revolution is different from others we've seen. A remarkable new book, Zapatista Stories for Dreaming an Other World, not another world, but an other world, has just come out from PM Press that approaches these questions through some of the parables the Zapatistas use in their organizing. With the aid of a couple of wonderful actors, I want to present two of the parables to you. But first, some background. Emiliano Zapata, you'll remember, was one of the great leaders in the early stage of the Mexican Revolution. The way he envisioned the possibility of another world was through land redistribution to the peasantry. Assassinated in 1919, his image and slogan, Tierra y Libertad, land and freedom, can still be seen on walls throughout southern Mexico, still an inspiration as conditions for people worsen through that neoliberal capitalist version of globalization. In various ways, the struggle he led has continued through to the present, signified by the EZLN incorporating his name in theirs. In an earlier episode of Another World is Possible, I focused on sociolinguistics, the different understandings of the world and its possibilities that are both built into and limited by the structure of our various languages. I talked there about my experience with an indigenous group in southern Mexico and how their life and language is conducive to a particularly democratic and ecological vision of revolution. That group, the Tocolabales, is one of seven communities, maybe nations, each consisting of many villages that constitute the Zapatista movement. You can find that episode on the Old Mole website as part of the program for September 15th, 2021. Land redistribution and the rebuilding of ejidos, the communal ownership of land, was one of the legacies of the Mexican Revolution. Then along came NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement of 1994. You may know of NAFTA from the standpoint of the United States, particularly the way it encouraged the loss of manufacturing jobs here and the flight of industry to cheaper labor in Mexico. But NAFTA has been equally hard, if not harder, on a huge part of the Mexican population. One of the preconditions of the treaty, one of the things the Mexican government had to agree to ahead of time, was the end of land redistribution and the disbanding of all ejidos. In other words, no communal land ownership, everything individually owned and available to the market. NAFTA went into effect on January 1st, 1994. On that same day, the EZLN launched its revolution throughout the state of Chiapas. Here's what one of its leaders said.
In this war of conquest, everything and all of us are subjected to the criterion of the market. Anything that opposes it or presents an obstacle will be eliminated. It implies the destruction of humanity as a socio-cultural collective and reconstructs it as a marketplace. Opposing neoliberalism, fighting against it, is not just one political or ideological option. It is a question of the survival of humanity.
The person who wrote those lines called himself Marcos. You may remember him from the iconic image, wearing a balaclava, smoking a pipe. The stories we'll present today are attributed to him. They're part of organizing efforts, building confidence and capabilities within the EZLN communities, reaching out, incorporating new communities, and expanding the EZLN territory, creating new ejidos, even in the face of government repression. The stories are playful and humorous, but also deadly serious. These are stories of a people embattled. The Zapatistas call their struggle una guerra contra el olvido, a war against oblivion. In both these stories, you'll notice something unusual for us. People smoke. That pipe of Marcos isn't just a personal vice. Among the Mayans, smoke signifies words, signifies conversation, resolving problems together through discussion. In the ancient hieroglyphics, those that survive after all the destruction by the European colonizers, speech is represented by smoke curling from the speaker's mouths. The first of our stories is told with the assistance of 11-year-old Liv Lyra Kohlberg, making her radio debut, playing a glasses-wearing, pipe-smoking, scholarly little beetle. Our disclaimer, no tobacco was actually consumed in the course of her performance. Dorito's story. Let me tell you a story about something that happened to me the other day. It's the story of a little beetle who wears glasses and smokes a pipe. I met him one day when I was looking for my tobacco and couldn't find it. All of a sudden, I saw to the side of my hammock that a little tobacco had fallen and was forming a thin trail. I followed it to figure out where my tobacco had gone and who the hell had taken it and was spilling it. A few meters away, behind a rock, I found a beetle sitting at a little desk, reading some papers, and smoking a tiny pipe. "Ahem, ahem," I said, so that the beetle would take note of my presence. But he paid no attention. So I said to him, "Hey, that tobacco is mine." The beetle took off his glasses, looked me over from top to bottom, and said very angrily,
"Please, Captain, I beg you not to interrupt me. Can't you see I'm studying?"
I was taken aback and was going to kick him out of the way. But then I calmed down and sat nearby to wait until he finished studying. After a while, he gathered his papers, put them away in his desk, and chewing his pipe, he said,
"Very well, then. How can I be of service to you, Captain?"
"My tobacco," I answered.
"Your tobacco? Would you like some?"
I started to get angry, but the little beetle passed me the bag of tobacco with his tiny leg as he added,
"Don't get angry, Captain. You need to understand that it is impossible to get tobacco around here, and I had to take some of yours."
I calmed down. I was beginning to like the beetle, so I told him, "Don't worry, I have more back there," he answered. "What is your name, sir?" I asked him.
"Nebuchadnezzar, but my friends call me Dorito. You may call me Dorito, Captain."
I thanked him for the honor and asked him what it was that he was studying.
"I am studying neoliberalism and its strategy to dominate Latin America,"
he answered. "What use is that to a beetle?" I asked him. He responded very angrily,
"What do you mean? What use? I have to know how long this fight of yours is going to last, and whether or not you are going to win. Besides, a beetle should care enough to study the situation of the own world he lives in. Don't you agree, Captain?"
"I don't know," I said. "Why do you want to know how long our fight is going to last, and whether we're going to win or not?"
"Clearly, you haven't understood a thing,"
he replied, putting on his glasses and lighting his pipe. After blowing a mouthful of smoke, he continued,
"It's in order to know how long we beetles need to be on the lookout so that you don't squash us under your enormous boots."
"Ah," I said. He said, "And what conclusion have you reached in your study?" I asked him. He took his papers from his desk and began leafing through them. He said every so often as he looked them over. When he had finished, he looked me in the eye and said,
"You are going to win."
"I already knew that," I said, and I added, "But how long is it going to take?"
"A long time,"
he told me, sighing with resignation. I knew that too already. "You don't know exactly how long, do you?" I asked.
"One cannot know exactly. One has to take into account many things. The objective conditions, the maturity of subjective conditions, the correlation of forces, the crisis of imperialism, the crisis of socialism, etc., etc."
I said.
"What are you thinking about, Captain?"
"Nothing," I answered. "Very well, Senor Dorito. I have to go. It was a pleasure meeting you. Please feel free to take as much tobacco as you want, whenever you want."
"Thank you, Captain. And there is no need to call me Senor."
"Thank you, Dorito. I will tell my troops that from now on, it is forbidden to step on beetles. I hope that helps."
"Thank you, Captain. That will be very helpful."
"In any case, you should still be careful, because my men are very absent-minded, and they don't always pay attention to where they put their feet."
"Understood, Captain."
"See you soon."
"See you. Come whenever you want and we can talk."
"I'll do that," I said, and returned to headquarters. That was Liv Lyra Kullberg with me, Norm Diamond, on KBOO Portland. So, how long will the struggle take? We can't know. What we can know, what we, the communities in struggle, must know, is that ultimately we will win. In the near term, however, there is the danger of being crushed, not only by heavy boots, but by the new world order of market relations and capitalism. But what is it we're up against, and how will we win? The second story approaches those questions at a profound level. Notice, of course, the reference to old moles. Well, to moles, anyway, young or old. Old Antonio, played in this story by honorary old mole Diane Hess, is based on a real person, a member of one of the indigenous communities who counseled and guided the Zapatistas in their formative years. The lion kills by looking. Old Antonio hunted a mountain lion with his ancient shotgun. I had made fun of his weapon just days before. They were using weapons like that when Hernan Cortes conquered Mexico, I had said to him. He defended himself.
Sure, but look who's wielding it now.
Now he is taking the last shreds of flesh from the hide to tan it. He proudly shows me the hide. It doesn't have a single hole in it.
Right in the eye. That's the only way to keep the hide intact.
What are you going to do with it? I ask. Old Antonio does not answer. He continues scraping the hide with his machete in silence. I sit down next to him, and after filling my pipe, attempt to roll him a corn husk cigarette. I silently offer it to him. He examines it and takes it apart.
You're not there yet,
he tells me as he re-rolls it. We sit down and begin the ceremony of smoking together. Between puffs, old Antonio spins the story.
The lion is strong because the other animals are weak. The lion eats their flesh because they allow him to eat it. The lion doesn't kill with his claws or fangs. The lion kills by looking. First, he approaches slowly in silence because he has clouds on his paws that dampen the noise. Next, he pounces and with a swipe takes his victim down, more by surprise than by force. After that, he just stares at his prey. The lion looks at his prey like this.
Old Antonio furrows his brow and fixes his black eyes on me.
The poor little animal who is going to die just stares. All it can do is look at the lion looking at it. The little animal no longer sees itself. It sees what the lion sees. It sees the image of a little animal, and in that gaze, it is small and weak. Before this, the little animal has never thought about whether it was small or weak. It was just a little animal, neither big nor small, neither strong nor weak. But now, seeing itself in the eyes of the lion, it sees fear. And seeing how it appears to the lion, the little animal all on its own, convinces itself that it is small and weak. And seeing the fear that the lion sees, it is afraid. And the little animal stops looking at anything, and its bones become numb, like when we get caught in the rain, in the mountains, in the night, in the cold. And the little animal surrenders, gives up. And the lion gobbles it down just like that. This is how the lion kills. He kills by looking. But there is one little animal that doesn't respond in this way. When he comes across the lion, he ignores him and continues as usual. If the lion swipes at him, he answers by clawing with his hands, which may be tiny, but the blood they draw certainly hurts. This little animal does not back down because he does not see the lion staring at him. He's blind. Mole is what they call this little animal.
Old Antonio seems to have finished talking. I venture a Yes, but old Antonio doesn't let me finish and continues telling the story while he rolls another cigarette. He does it slowly, turning to look at me every so often to make sure I am still paying attention.
Mole went blind because instead of looking outward, he began to look into his heart. He insisted on looking inward. No one knows how this idea of looking inward got into the mole's head. The mole was so stubborn about looking into his heart that he didn't worry about things like strong or weak, big or small. Because the heart is the heart, and it isn't measured the way things and animals are. However, it so happens that only the gods were permitted to look inward. So they punished the mole, and they didn't allow him to look outward anymore. Even worse, they condemned him to live and crawl under the earth. And that's why the mole lives underground, because the gods punished him. But the mole wasn't even upset, since he continued looking inward. That's why the mole is not afraid of the lion. And neither is the man who knows how to look into his heart. Because the man who knows how to look into his heart does not see the strength of the lion. What he sees is the strength of his heart. And then he looks at the lion, who sees the man looking at him. There in the man's gaze, the lion sees that he is a mere lion and sees himself being stared at. And he is afraid and runs away.
So did you look into your heart to kill this lion? I interrupt.
Me? No way. I concentrated on where the gun was aimed and where the lion's eye was and fired. Just like that. My heart didn't even cross my mind.
I scratch my head the way they do around here whenever they don't understand something. Old Antonio stands up slowly. He takes the hide and examines it carefully. Then he rolls it up and hands it to me.
Take it. It's for you. So you never forget that the lion and fear are both killed by knowing where to look.
Old Antonio turns around and goes inside his home. In old Antonio's language, that means, I'm done. Adios. I put the hide of the lion in my nylon bag and leave. Stories exist in contexts, and words have meanings in particular contexts. Moles are a common way to refer to comrades among the Zapatistas, as in addressing someone as Hermano Topo, Brother Mole. Looking inward is also a common phrasing, referring not to individual contemplation, but rather to finding answers within a shared culture that's under attack. Going back to our true heart has a more concrete meaning than might appear to us. The true heart is the community assembly I described in that earlier radio piece on sociolinguistics. This is a story about resisting hegemony, about not giving in to the seeming power of the state and dominant culture, about drawing on the strength of one's own community, culture, and organizing. The gods in this culture are not all-knowing, all-powerful. They too have assemblies, confer with each other, and change their minds. As to the lion, here's what Joanne Wypijewski says in her lyrical and insightful foreword.
The ferocious animal is enlisted in parables not to inflate danger, which only reinforces the eternal victim, but to encourage us to take a true measure of it and of our own powers. The lowliest creature teaches the necessity of reason and its attributes. Humans must observe, listen, assess, come to an understanding, and be able to laugh at themselves. Fearlessness is not part of the sequence. Humanity is not fearless. It is aware.
I'll conclude with one more story. This one, not a parable, but an account of a true event. I mentioned that old Antonio was a real person. At a crucial time in the early organizing, he waited with Marcos outside the meeting place where his own community was deciding whether to join the projected uprising. Probably they smoked, and Antonio taught Marcos more about their language and culture. Finally, the assembly ended, and Antonio's son brought them the result of the deliberation. Here's what it said. The men, women, and children assembled at the school in the community to see in our hearts if it was time to begin the war for freedom. We split into three groups to debate: women, children, and men. After that, we all came back together in the schoolhouse, and the majority reached the conclusion that the war had to begin, because Mexico was already selling itself off to foreigners. And while hunger may come and go, if we are no longer Mexicans, that will be forever. This agreement was reached by 12 men, 23 women, and 8 children capable of reasoning, and was signed by all those who knew how. Those who didn't, signed with their thumbprint. I'm tempted to say that the rest is history, except the history continues. The EZLN is held out against army and paramilitaries. They're building schools, clinics, and further communal land ownership. They've been and continue to be a catalyst for groups around the world aiming at social change. I've been talking about and drawing on Zapatista stories for dreaming an other world, translated and with very interesting commentaries by an ad hoc group, the Colectivo Relámpago, the Lightning Collective, with a foreword by Joanne Wipajewski. For the Old Mole, this has been Norm Diamond, accompanied by Liv Lyra Kohlberg, Diane Hess, and Patricia Kohlberg. Patricia did a recent Old Mole segment on Hazel Scott, the great jazz pianist who defied the House Un-American Activities Committee, and basically, as a result, ended her career. Her defiance was not because she was a communist, but simply as a black woman who'd experienced multiple forms of discrimination on principle. One of her specialties was taking pieces of classical music and turning them into jazz. Listen to what she does with Rachmaninoff's Prelude in C-sharp minor. Thank you. We'll return with more Hazel Scott. But first, Ursula Le Guin on how she must be a man. Celebrating women's history runs into a problem in that for much of history, women weren't acknowledged to exist. In response, Le Guin developed this performance piece, Introducing Myself. Here it is from the Old Mole Archives. In honor of International Women's History Month, and I hope in honor of one of my favorite authors, Ursula Le Guin, and with the double irony of me, not a woman, portraying a woman, who in turn is portraying a man, well, if that sounds confusing, you'll get it once I start. Just imagine it's Ursula speaking, though you're hearing my voice. And when she, that is, I, starts out by saying, I am a man, she's making a gender statement, not referring to the demand for racial dignity of the striking Memphis sanitation workers in 1964, where Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. You remember, they too insisted, I am a man. So, here goes. Introducing myself. I am a man. Now you may think I've made some kind of silly mistake about gender, or maybe that I'm trying to fool you, because my first name ends in an A, and I own 3 bras, and I've been pregnant 5 times, and other things like that that you might have noticed. Little details. I am a man, and I want you to believe and accept this as a fact, just as I did for many years. You see, when I was growing up at the time of the wars of the Medes and Persians, and when I went to college just after the Hundred Years' War, and when I was bringing up my children during the Korean, Cold, and Vietnam Wars, there were no women. Women are a very recent invention. I predate the invention of women by decades. Well, if you insist on pedantic accuracy, women have been invented several times in widely varying localities, but the inventors just didn't know how to sell the product. Their distribution techniques were rudimentary, and their market research was nil, and so, of course, the concept just didn't get off the ground. Even with a genius behind it, an invention has to find its market. And it seemed like for a long time, the idea of women just didn't make it to the bottom line. Models like the Austin and the Bronte were too complicated, and people just laughed at the suffragette. And the Virginia Woolf was way too far ahead of its time. So when I was born, there actually were only men. People were men. They all had one pronoun, his pronoun. So that's who I am. I am the generic he, as in, if anybody needs an abortion, he will have to go to another state. Or, a writer knows which side his bread is buttered on. That's me, the writer, him. I am a man. Not maybe a first-rate man. I'm perfectly willing to admit that I may be, in fact, a kind of second-rate or imitation man, a pretend-a-him. As a him, I am to a genuine male him, as a microwaved fish stick is to a whole grilled Chinook salmon. I mean, after all, can I inseminate? Can I belong to the Bohemian Club? Can I run General Motors? Theoretically, I can, but you know where theory gets us, not to the top of General Motors. And then, I can't write my name with P in the snow, or it would be awfully laborious if I did. I can't shoot my wife and children and some neighbors and then myself. Oh, to tell you the truth, I can't even drive. I never got my license. I chickened out. I take the bus. That is terrible, I admit it. I am actually a very poor imitation or substitute man. And you could see it when I tried to wear those army surplus clothes with ammunition pockets that were trendy, and I looked like a hen in a pillowcase. I am shaped wrong. People are supposed to be lean. You can't be too thin. Everybody says so. People are supposed to be lean and taut, because that's how men generally are, lean and taut. Or anyhow,
That's how a lot of men start out. And some of them even stay that way. And men are people. People are men. That has been well established. And so people, real people, the right kind of people, are lean. But I'm really lousy at being people, because I'm not lean at all, but sort of podgy, with actual fat places. I am untaught. And then people are supposed to be tough. Tough is good. But I've never been tough. I'm sort of soft, and actually sort of tender, like a good steak, or like Chinook salmon, which isn't lean and tough, but very rich and tender. But then, salmon aren't people. Or anyhow, we have been told that they aren't in recent years. We have been told that there is only one kind of people, and they are men. And I think it is very important that we all believe that. It certainly is important to the men. What it comes down to, I guess, is that I am just not manly, like Ernest Hemingway was manly. The beard and the guns and the wives and the little short sentences. I do try. I have this sort of beardoid thing that keeps trying to grow 9 or 10 hairs on my chin, sometimes even more. But what do I do with the hairs? I tweak them out. Would a man do that? Men don't tweak. Men shave. Anyhow, white men shave, being hairy. And I have even less choice about being white or not than I do about being a man or not. I am white whether I like being white or not. The doctors can do nothing for me. But I do my best not to be white, I guess, under the circumstances, since I don't shave. I tweak. But it doesn't mean anything, because I don't really have a real beard that amounts to anything. And I don't have a gun, and I don't have even one wife, and my sentences tend to go on and on and on with all this syntax in them. Ernest Hemingway would have died rather than have syntax, or semicolons. I use a whole lot of half-assed semicolons. There was one of them, just now. And another thing, Ernest Hemingway would have died rather than get old. And he did. He shot himself. A short sentence. Anything rather than a long sentence. A life sentence. Death sentences are short and very, very manly. Life sentences aren't. They go on and on, all full of syntax and qualifying clauses and confusing references and getting old. And that brings up the real proof of what a mess I have made of being a man. I am not even young. Just about the time they finally started inventing women, I started getting old, and I went right on doing it, shamelessly. I have allowed myself to get old and haven't done one single thing about it, with a gun or anything. What I mean is, if I had any real self-respect, wouldn't I at least have had a facelift or some liposuction? Although, liposuction sounds to me like what they do a lot of on TV when they are young or youngish, though not when they are old, and when one of them is a man and the other a woman, though not under any other circumstances. What they do is, this young or youngish man and woman take hold of each other and slide their hands around on each other, and then they perform liposuction. You are supposed to watch them while they do it. They move their heads around and flatten out their mouth and nose on the other person's mouth and nose, and open their mouths in different ways, and you are supposed to feel sort of hot or wet or something as you watch. What I feel is like I'm watching two people doing liposuction. And this is why they finally invented women? Surely not. As a matter of fact, I think sex is even more boring as a spectator sport than all the other spectator sports, even baseball. If I am required to watch a sport instead of doing it, I'll take show jumping. The horses are really good looking. The people who ride them are mostly these sort of Nazis, but like all Nazis, they are only as powerful and successful as the horse they are riding. And it is, after all, the horse who decides whether to jump that 5-barred gate or stop short and let the Nazi fall off over its neck. Only, usually the horse doesn't remember it has the option. Horses aren't awfully bright. But in any case, show jumping and sex have a good deal in common, though you can usually only get show jumping on American TV if you can pick up a Canadian channel, which is not true of sex. Given the option, though I often forget that I have an option, I certainly would watch show jumping and do sex, never the other way around. But I'm too old now for show jumping, and as for sex, who knows? I do. You don't. Of course, golden oldies are supposed to jump from bed to bed these days, just like horses jumping the 5-barred gates, bounce, bounce, bounce. But a good deal of this super sex at 70 business seems to be theory again, like the woman CEO of General Motors. Theory is invented mostly to reassure people in their 40s, that is, men, who are worried. That is why we had Karl Marx and why we still have economists, though we seem to have lost Karl Marx. As such, theory is dandy. As for practice, or praxis, as the Marxists used to call it, apparently because they liked X's, you wait till you are 60 or 70, and then you can tell me about your sexual practice, or praxis, if you want to, though I make no promises that I will listen. And if I do listen, I will probably be extremely bored and start looking for some show jumping on the TV. In any case, you are not going to hear anything from me about my sexual practice or praxis, then, now, or ever. But all that aside, here I am, old. When I wrote this, I was 60 years old, a 60-year-old smiling public man, as Yeats said. But then he was a man. And now I am over 70, and it's all my own fault. I get born before they invent women, and I live all these decades trying so hard to be a good man that I forget all about staying young, and so I didn't. And my tenses get all mixed up. I just am young, and then all of a sudden I was 60, and maybe 80. And what next? Not a whole lot. I keep thinking there must have been something that a real man could have done about it, something short of guns, but more effective than oil of Olay. But I failed. I did nothing. I absolutely failed to stay young. And then I look back on all my strenuous efforts, because I really did try. I tried hard to be a man, to be a good man, and I see how I failed at that. I am at best a bad man, an imitation, phony, second-rate him with a 10-hair beard and semicolons. And I wonder, what was the use? Sometimes I think I might just as well give the whole thing up. Sometimes I think I might just as well exercise my option, stop short in front of the 5-barred gate, and let the Nazi fall off onto his head. If I'm no good at pretending to be a man, and no good at being young, I might just as well start pretending that I am an old woman. I'm not sure that anybody has invented old women yet, but it might be worth trying. That was an Ursula Le Guin performance piece, introducing myself, very slightly adapted by me. You can find it online or in her collection, The Wave in the Mind.
Before signing off, I want to alert you to this coming Wednesday's appearance in Portland by Steve Early and Suzanne Gordon. Steve's been a guest on The Old Mole more than once, on labor issues, on efforts to remake municipal government in Richmond, California. They'll be addressing labor, veterans, healthcare profiteering, and the fight against privatization. That's this Wednesday, 6:30 p.m., at the First Unitarian Church on Southwest 12th. We'll go out with some more Hazel Scott. Listen to what she does with Chopin's Minute Waltz. I'd like to thank Fran Michel and Patricia Kohlberg, old moles both, and guest artists Liv Lyra Kohlberg and Diane Hess. As always, a shout out to the KBOO staff who keeps us going. For you, our listeners, catch us next Monday morning. Meanwhile, stay safe and stay active.